23rd episode of Reverse Vote Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
This week, Hugh Morris, the chief executive of the ECB, said of players using Twitter, "It's like giving a machine gun to a monkey. It can be fantastic or it can be an absolute disaster. Here on Reverse Vote Radio, we are your monkeys and the mics are our machine guns."
And this week, we're going to be turning our fire on all kinds of exciting things. Not least the question of when giving a machine gun to a monkey can be a good idea.
We've got to ask Hugh Morris. We've got to get him on here, pin him down. Yeah. What moment has he ever seen monkeys, machine guns contributing positively to the greater good?
But what has been the real excitement of the last week, as far as we're concerned, is watching Australia being routed for 47.
It's very easy choosing who to support in a series that Australia are involved in, at least for an England fan.
Unless they're playing South Africa.
Oh, do you find this a difficult one?
No, I don't. I have more of a... Well, I did have a soft spot for the South Africans, but I just never support the Australians. That's certainly true.
I can't think of a combination of international teams that would lead me to support Australia. But in this case, this 47 was a lot of fun to watch for an England fan, but it was also at the heart of what was just an astonishing day's play. South Africa had early collapsed for 97, and Australia really looked incredibly well set up in this game.
And the pitch didn't look... I mean, I haven't seen... You've seen more of the highlights than I have. I've only seen a few minutes worth, but the pitch didn't look particularly malicious.
South Africa bowled well. I thought Philander bowled well, but plenty of the wickets were just gifted to them. I mean, in a particular moment, Hussey came in with it on 13 for 4 and decided to have a poke outside off some really wild shot for a very experienced player. And it was compelling to watch just because Australia seemed to be suffering a sort of collective mental breakdown. You had really top quality batsmen looking completely
hapless. And particularly
hapless.
When the... They were so on top, having skittled the South Africans in there.
There was no excuse for nerves, was
exactly,
there, really?
Exactly.
I think some purists were quick to respond and say, well, look, this is disgraceful. This is Test cricket. It's a real proof of dropping standards. I think the rest of us just enjoyed what was pretty much sheer drama. So away from that 47, what's been getting you excited? Or should I say who?
Who has been? Well, I've been rather enjoying the kind of batsman that Australia could have done with in that match. Craig Brathwaite is not only spells Craig in a particularly ridiculous
way. It is
way,
very exciting.
But he hasn't really burst onto the scene for the West Indies, but in the first test against the Indians, his 63 from 212 balls was not only from... I mean, he has the odds stacked against him for being a patient opening batsman. One, he's West Indian. Two, he's 18. Or is he 19? 18 or 19.
18. He's 18. 18 years of age.
But for both of those reasons, you expect him to be sort of the next Chris Gayle. But what he's shown is, I think, some of the backbone that has... which makes me so excited
and
about the West Indian
side. And there was a beautiful sub-story to this, which is that Braithwaite openly cites Chanderpaul as his hero.
Yep.
And the pair of them came together. I think there's almost 20 years of difference in age. And they put together a century partnership that really kind of gave the West Indies a foundation.
And it's kind of quite difficult to have Chanderpaul as your hero. It's a bit like having Chris Tavares or someone.
I have no problem having Chanderpaul as my hero.
Okay, fair enough. Any West Indian you'd have as your hero.
But if Braithwaite is part... And I think what disappointed me this week, what let me down was the fact that Braithwaite and the other talented young West Indian batsmen, because there's a group of them coming through, ended up wasting what was a great position to win the first test against India. You know, anyone who's listened to this podcast for more than about 5 minutes knows that I'm guilty of eternal West Indies optimism. I always see them on the verge of a new dawn. But I really think what Sammy and Otis Gibson are doing there is exciting. They're backing young players, they're pushing them, and they're in such a good position here. They had a 95-run first innings lead, just couldn't make it count. And it's actually a real shame, but it's great to see Brathwaite, great to see Powell, great to see Darren Bravo, who I think made 130 today in the second test.
And Adrian Barrett as well, another very exciting test player. Where the West Indies could have, you know, when they followed on, they could have lain down and just been beaten even more thoroughly by an innings. They were beaten by an innings, but they showed a lot of character.
They did
that,
show it from a hopeless position. They fought back quite impressively.
By making 400 off.
I suppose you've been focusing on slightly more serious matters off the pitch.
Yeah, so the death of Peter Roebuck. I mean, he was a strange chap, and it's been sort of a strange story. And the nature of his death, his suicide, and all the allegations that have been flying about sort of straight away after it, has, I think, in a sense, overshadowed the fact that his writing made a real impact on the game. he was a strange character, starting off obviously as a Somerset captain, and never played for England, and ended up falling out badly with England and going to Australia.
And obviously made a few enemies eventually towards the end of his career at Somerset as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I think what's sad is obviously there hasn't the mysterious or murky circumstances around his death have kind of denied everyone an opportunity for maybe a more fitting tribute. I think what can be said is his writing was consistently informative and excellent.
Absolutely. I mean, I used to spend more time than I should browsing articles on the Crick Info website, and a lot of his that were up there were always on bizarre subjects, and he occupied a kind of fairly unique place because he wasn't partisan and he wasn't particularly sort of nationalistic, and he had a very unique voice and a very unique position talking about a lot of things, and I think that would be very missed. So, from the archives, and this week Andy is going to tell us about that most divisive part of cricket, the bouncer.
In 1975, Lord Brockway said that cricket used to be a synonym for honourable conduct. It is now becoming a synonym for brute force. And there's little doubt that he had the bouncer very much at the forefront of his mind when he said this. There are always going to be those like Brockway who see it as really a stain on cricket's honour. I think the dividing line is a sense that the moment you're targeting the batsman rather than the stumps, you're crossing a moral boundary. In a sense, a game and a sport is becoming a sort of activity of combat, almost. I think the footage that sort of best demonstrates this kind of school of thought is one that I think sort of almost everyone has watched at some point, is that compelling and quite painful footage of Brian Close facing Michael Holding during the infamous Will Make Them Grovel 1976 series. And even today, I mean, I've watched it again and again, that footage, and it's physically painful to watch, isn't it? You know, watching Close take blow after blow, it's extremely painful.
But I think there is a difference between that and using the bouncer to someone who's dancing down the pitch. I mean, so this I don't think it's as clear as saying you either attack the pitch or you attack the body, because LB decisions are hitting the body rather than
striking the body.
And I think there is a place for. I agree that there's a difference between bowling fast yorkers that didn't crush people's toes and Close being bounced time and time again and coming in covered in blood. But I think that there is a place, there's an argument that there's a place for physical danger within the game. And actually there's also an argument that when during the Bodyline series, that the only reason that Bradman got annoyed about Bodyline and the Australian batsman got annoyed about Bodyline was because they weren't good enough to play it. There's always this question of whether, that a good batsman should
score runs. We looked at the Leary Constantine's books a few episodes ago, and he made the point that actually it should really be a scoring opportunity. I think why perhaps the bounce has become accepted is that at its best, perhaps, it really adds to that contest between bat and ball that's fundamental. I think what makes the Close footage difficult is that it doesn't feel like a contest.
No.
For various reasons, perhaps some to do with the pitch, perhaps some to do with maybe a lack of experience, frankly, with playing fast bowling that was that aggressive that quick. It felt like an assault almost. It was just completely one way, struck again and again. And actually that isn't fun to watch.
No.
And in that case, you can perhaps understand where Brockway and sort of his ilk, who maybe still uncomfortable, were coming from. I think I've kind of decided to focus on two recent-ish bouncers that I think say a lot about the bouncer's current role in the game. I'll take you to 2008, when Brett Lee struck Shiv Chanderpaul, who's already come up this evening, with a vicious
Shiv Chanderpaul
bouncer.
Your ears should be bouncing, or ears should be turning red.
Turning red, yeah. No, he's getting a starring role in this episode. But anyway, Brett Lee struck Chanderpaul with a vicious bouncer to the back of the head. Chanderpaul was lying unconscious on the pitch. Incredibly emotive footage came up on TV of his wife bursting into tears in the crowd. But after a few minutes, Chanderpaul got up, he composed himself and completed a vital 100. Sabina Parkes rose to acclaim him. The interesting thing about this is there was no hand-wringing as to whether the game had become dangerous. There were none of the commentators sort of suggesting, God, this is an unacceptable level of danger. Most fascinatingly, I think, perhaps, looking at the history of the game, there was no blame attached to the way Brett Lee had bowled. He even bounced Chanderpaul after he got up from the pitch, clearly slightly groggy. There was no uproar about that. There was a sense this was a legitimate tactic being used. Instead, the focus was on Chanderpaul, the courage he'd shown and the courage he'd displayed in terms of getting over that bouncer. And I think that's maybe the point. Physical danger, incorporating that into the game the way the bouncer does actually give an opportunity for courage.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a side of the game that we don't sort of see as much as we used to when we, you know, see one of the things that was distinctive about the 2005 Ashes was the bowlers going off every 10 minutes to have, you know, spend half an hour with the masseurs in the in the changing room. And we and there is a it's a slightly uncomfortable view, I suppose, but there is a sense in which cricket can be too clinical when it's not seen as being sort of aggressive and
but exactly because it's almost hard to see people as heroic unless they're exposed to a degree of danger. I mean, clearly there are limits to this. You know, we're happy that batsmen. I mean, I'm certainly happy that batsmen are wearing helmets to protect themselves. Yep. But the element of danger does add an element of heroism to it as well. The second bouncer I wanted to look at was back in that famous 2005 series. It's the first morning at Lord's, and Harmison strikes Ponting with a bouncer that drew blood. More notable than the delivery itself was the cheer that it was met with around Lord's. And I think, while some perhaps may have been uncomfortable that, it was very clear that it's now acceptable for a large number of fans to actually celebrate an opposition batsman being struck. As you say, I think some people may continue to feel uncomfortable with that, but I think that cheer and that acclaim said a lot to me about maybe changing norms within the game and amongst fans.
What I think was very interesting about... Well, what's interesting about both of those examples is that they were one-off. It wasn't a barrage where, you know, it was five balls out of six were bouncers. It was individual balls that were very, very good bouncers. Like that Harmison ball on that first morning at Lord's was a fantastic bouncer. There was no real way that Ponty could have got out of the way of it. There's everything that a bouncer wants to do. What was another, just to throw another example into the mix, Yuvraj Singh at Trent Bridge this summer. He was. I was lucky enough to be there on the fourth day when England wrapped up their victory in the series victory. Was it the series victory? Then anyway, the victory in the Test. And he had struggled against a bouncer very early on in his innings. And Tim Bresnan and Broad, in fact, who were bowling at both ends, basically just bowled him three balls and over for bouncers, and he really, really struggled with them, and ended up with playing one round to short leg where Cook caught him, having played a very, very uncomfortable innings. And actually, I felt more uncomfortable about that because he did actually look fairly afraid of the balls, basically, than of the one-off really, really sharp bouncer that hit someone in the head.
And perhaps it comes back to that idea of a contest. Mm. It's when a batsman looks ill-equipped to play the bouncer that it maybe leaves us feeling awkward.
Exactly, which is why one of the worst things in the game is watching tail-enders
play. Yeah, indeed.
Mostly because it's the most completely ineffective way of getting a tail-ender out. Mm. You just bowl fast.
Why not bowl fast and straight? Mm. I mean, I think just you're finishing on that Harmison bouncer. It's sort of, for me, become a bit of an emblem of what that England side meant, really. It was a statement that they weren't going to be another walkover, you know, even though they were to lose that Lord's Test, that they wanted to be taken seriously, they were going to demand that they were taken seriously. I mean, finally, just to finish off, a couple of reflections on, you know, what makes a perfect bouncer, what's great. I mean, I think sheer pace, in a way, pace has become quite unfashionable in the game. We focus more on swing bowling, perhaps, but sheer pace remains key. I mean, I think most batsmen get themselves into trouble when they misjudge the pace. There's also the issue of where the trajectory of the ball. So the bouncer does definitely still need to be rising when it gets to the batsman. But actually, it's those that rise slightly less than expected that are often the most dangerous. There was this fantastic ball that Jimmy Anderson bowled to Tendulkar back in 2007. Tendulkar, who's a relatively short man, appeared to have ducked under it with relatively comfort. Yeah. It stayed low and hit him a fearsome blow to the face guard. It really sort of shook him up. But I think the one element that bowlers actually have the least control over, but actually creates the ultimate bouncer, is that element of surprise. And it will be those balls that land on a good length, but leap up at a batsman, that will remain the most unplayable ones. But, I mean, many batsmen would disagree when I say this, but sadly, in a way, erratic bounce is becoming less and less of a feature of the game. And I mean, that whole skill set to deal with it is becoming less and less of a required ability for batsmen. ¶¶ this week we're looking at a book of which The Guardian said, to say it is the best cricket book ever written is pifflingly inadequate praise. Beyond a Boundary by C.L.R. James.
It's difficult to know where to start here, really. This is a book, this is a man whose life reigns so far, not just a cricket writer and a pretty shocking cricketer, but anyway, we'll gloss over that.
I don't think he was that shocking.
Not just a cricket writer, but a politician, a revolutionary, a man who changed the place of the West Indies in world cricket and the place of the West Indies in the political sphere as well. A Trotskyite who actually, perhaps his greatest achievement was bringing politics and cricket together so convincingly into the same sphere. There's just so much to talk about in this book. If you haven't read it, read it. And, you know, in a sense, there's not much more to say than that.
C.L.R. James kind of, one of his contributions to cricket writing is that famous line, what do they of cricket know who only cricket know? Mm. Probably just misquoted that famous line, but anyway, close enough.
Yep.
And his life is kind of the sort of definitive proof of that, isn't it? I mean, some guy who cricket was always a central part of his life, but he was able to compare and contrast it with so many other kind of avenues.
And actually, that is why cricket was a central part of his life, because it wasn't isolated. For him, it wasn't a game. Mm. For him, it was art and poetry. And actually, for him, it became a vital part in the big struggle in his life, which was to get the West Indies independence from colonial rule. So basically, it's a kind of behemoth of a book. And we've picked out two little strands to talk about.
I think perhaps, I mean, I would like to start on the sort of, I guess the more C.L.R. James as a cricket writer, because I think it's easy to forget, maybe amongst his impressive life story, that much of the finest prose he created was writing on the game. Famously, he got his first sort of gig, as it were, on cricket writing when he just saw Sidney Barnes play, was very taken with it, went home and knocked off 1,500 words on it. A friend of his, Leary Constantine, of all people, said, send it to Neville Cardus. Cardus was so taken with it, he offered him a job. You know, wonderful.
It's a fantastic story, and it's also because, Sidney Barnes was then about 45. Mm. So Sidney Barnes at the end of his career, Neville Cardus when he was just getting established, and then C.L.R. James right at the beginning of his career as well. And it's this great mix of these great figures of early 20th century.
And I think, I mean, within Beyond a Boundary, it's his pen portraits of West Indian cricketers who he had loved, often West Indian cricketers whose names are not really immediately familiar to us. And there's just one I'd really like to focus on, is his work on Wilton St. Hill, a batsman who he describes in the same sort of words as, in the same sort of sense as Bradman, you know, real great. But a batsman who sadly for various reasons never made it kind of on the international scale. And these pen portraits are incredibly powerful. I mean, firstly, C.L.R. James, as someone who knows the game intimately, is very comfortable on the technical side of it. He focuses on what makes these players great. And within Wilton St. John, he talks about the fact that there had never been a player.
Yeah.
So what have I just called him? Wilton St. John. I have just morphed him into
St. John. Well, I mean, you know,
there are lots of saints.
Celestial element.
But he talks about his extraordinary ability to judge the ball early in the flight. The fact that he never saw anyone, neither Bradman or Sobers, who saw the ball more quickly nor made up his mind earlier. Time, he always had plenty of time. And there's a wonderful thing, it's a wonderful attribute for a cricket writer to have, to see what in the essence of a great player is. And I think to actually technically break down a player's ability. Away from that, the technical side, he has wonderful ability to get to the personality of these players as well, because ultimately that's what makes a portrait interesting, a written portrait. It's more than just a description of how they played the game. It was sort of the person involved. And this wonderful line to sum up Wilton St. I was going to call him St. James at that point.
I'm working my way through
the saints, Wilton St. Hill. He talks of his spirit was untamable, perhaps too much so. And it's incredibly evocative language. And he's a player who obviously I've never seen, a player of which I know nothing. And you read this description, it's incredibly evocative description, both of the kind of player he was and of the way he played the game and of his personality. Mm. Also, your wonderful eye for anecdotes as well talks about him smoking as he walked out to bat. And it's an image that's very easy to sort of, very easy to capture.
I think that a lot of that ability to pick up on and analyse and also make into great literature certain details of the game is explained in a sense at the beginning of the book when you hear about the fact that he grew up in a house that looked out sort of behind the bowler's arm. Mm. He says he has the best seat in the house from sort of his bedroom window, and that all the characters, they have a neighbour who's particularly disreputable and no one likes him apart from the fact that he's just an exquisite batsman, and no one can quite reconcile the fact that he's an awful human being and apparently goes out and sleeps with anyone in town and etc. and is at the same time a beautiful batsman.
Exactly, and yet the entire town will condemn him for one and yet will turn up to watch him bat on the
and
other.
Praise him for the other. And so as well as being able to, I think that gives him two abilities. It gives him an ability to be really comfortable in describing and talking about the really sort of fine detail points of the game, but it also allows him to think about the game on the grandest scale. And towards the end of Beyond a Boundary, C.L.R. James turns his attention to several pretty big topics, one of which is cricket art, and he comes down very much on the side of saying cricket is absolutely art. But another question to which he turns is sort of the question of how much cricket is a product of culture and how much cricket affects culture. And he writes very well about the 1950s when cricket sort of nearly died in a sense. You had Len Hutton leading England in a way that you sort of would go out and score as many runs as you possibly could and then bowl as slowly and as far outside off stump as you possibly could, and if you won it was a bloody miracle, but that was how you played your cricket. And he comes up with the rather wonderful idea of the sort of welfare state manner of the game at the time, and the way that culture affects cricket is a very interesting dynamic that he talks about.
It's interesting because he is ferociously intellectual, and yet he's sort of never pretentious with it, is he? He's very comfortable talking about big ideas, and these connections between sort of cricket and art, cricket and history, they come so naturally to him. And I think this comes back to what we were talking about just at the start. The way that we maybe in modern society are very quick to separate these into different fields. I mean, if you just make the obvious point of, say, a newspaper, the sports and the arts pages of the newspaper are very definitive. And, I think we're inclined to look down upon the sports pages, actually, aren't we, as sort of the lesser news.
Yep, exactly. And I think there's one last thing I'd like to sort of discuss briefly is the way that he talks about, related to this idea of cricket and cricket and the culture of the age being sort of reflecting one another, is this idea which I think is still very pertinent now. It's particularly pertinent now, which is that cricket gets itself into a rut that it thinks can't be changed unless someone comes along and imposes change from on top. So in the 50s, when cricket was seen
struggling
by a lot of people as dying effectively, there were people coming along saying you should put a fourth stump in so the bowlers would bowl at the stumps. Mm. Len Hutton came along and said you should shorten the pitch so that things got more exciting. And he's saying, well, no, the point about cricket is that it can be changed by, as he puts it, sort of heroes within the game who can come along and can challenge the conventions of the time and are good enough to challenge the conventions of the time. And I think that's quite a sort of an interesting lesson, as at the moment, the ICC is coming along and thinking of all kinds of crazy ideas that it wants to
And perhaps it's quite reassuring as well in another age where we're now considering the future of cricket and the sort of the threats that face it, the fact that this is a challenge that cricket's faced before. And without wanting to put words into his mouth, there's a sense that you imagine James would look at a lot of these problems now and probably have faith in there being maybe players perhaps leading sort of a solution to it.
Exactly. And maybe there's just one wonderful quotation from the end of part six of the book, which is this. He describes sort of these kind of players who are going to be game changers, as it were, as romantics. And he says, "Our romantic will do new things and the big battalions will follow in his train. We shall extol his eyesight, his wrist work, his footwork, his audacity, to which some nationalist fanatics will add his ancestry and his climate. He may come from Pudsey or South Sydney, Nwana, I don't know how you pronounce that, or Bridgetown. But wherever he comes from and whatever he does, he will be doing what W.G. Grace did, so reshaping the medium of cricket that it can give new satisfactions to new people. So, to the debate, and this week the ICC postponed the Test Cricket World Championship until 2017. We're asking whether they should be holding it at all.
Let's remember there's a reason this is being discussed, there's a reason it's being introduced. Test cricket is in many ways going through, let's not be maladressive, let's not call it a crisis, let's call it a very, very difficult period. If you watched any of the wonderful game between India and the West Indies at Eden Gardens, incredibly low attendances. This huge, mighty stadium left largely empty. And it's worth remembering that the Test Championship hasn't been considered, discussed, or its introduction proposed for no reason. This is a game that badly needs a shot in the foot. And the Test Championship provides a pinnacle, it provides a target for the game, and perhaps most importantly, it shows that the ICC are looking to address what is a decline in interest, and perhaps more importantly, a decline, Test cricket's decline in terms of its role in the overall game. More 2020s are reducing the number of times, a new number of amounts for Test. Similarly, we're getting 7 one-day international series and 2 Test match series. Test match series of only 2 Tests. So it's worth remembering that this is being discussed for a reason. The Test match cricket is in trouble. The second thing is, if we look at the rankings, they're very unconvincing. In a lot of ways, there's something very inconclusive about them. There's a sense that they don't provide maybe a definitive answer. Yes, there are obviously problems and there are issues with judging the best team in the world on the basis of a series. But, nevertheless, it does provide perhaps a more conclusive and I think for many a more satisfying result or conclusion than the rankings. Finally, it is to be hoped that having a Test Championship as an ultimate end goal might lead to an improvement in the whole future tour's schedule. There might be a sense whereby if you have that as an end goal, the rest of the series need in some way to build up and lead to it.
Instead of what we have
at the moment, that's very respectful arguing. In terms of the current system, which is very chaotic, we have certain countries that haven't played series against for a while. There is a hope that having a final endpoint may help to rationalise that schedule somewhat. Okay, it's your turn now. Well, show me how I'm idiotic. Well, or whatever inappropriate
word. For a start,
your
assertion that the fact that the Test Championship has been discussed shows that in some way it's a good idea. It's ridiculous. The ICC spend their entire time discussing things because they've got nothing better to do than to be paid to be administrators. Of course, they've got to justify their job somehow. So they're coming up about harebrained schemes like Test Championships is exactly how they're going to do it. What I really worry about the ICC Test Championships is that actually it doesn't address any of the real problems. It's you can't just impose a new structure from above and say, oh, it's gonna address all the problems of why people aren't going and watching cricket. And there are so many reasons that audiences,
people
have declined across the world, as we say, as we've reached our 7 billionth or whatever the figure is. But there are so many reasons. One of the things that we've seen happen time and time again with the ICC is they've gone, okay, let's do a Test Championship, whatever it is, let's do it, and it'll just solve all our problems, and then we can just go on and live happily ever after. And it's never happened at all. And I think the one really unique thing about Test cricket is that it really doesn't lend itself to any kind of tournament whatsoever. I mean, for goodness sake, we're still complaining, both after the World Cup in the West Indies and then the more recent one in India. We're complaining that a one-day World Cup takes too long. And it's not just simply a case of how long people are in a certain place for a certain time. If you were to play a Test Championship over 3 years, people would get lost. People would lose interest in it. There's no way that you can sustain interest in Test cricket within that structure. It lends itself. There's a reason that it's played within series. And yes, there's a problem to in the fact that we have a lot of two test series played, and in fact it's a problem that we were discussing last week. But I don't think it's realistic to say that bringing in a world, you know, bringing in a world test championship will somehow, so I really don't see how it's going to solve that. Bringing in a new format that will take more time away from test series is going to solve the fact that test series are played are very short.
I think, so if you look at the issue, the problem with test cricket at the moment in terms of its ability to attract interest seems to be a sense, perhaps, of a lack of understanding of the importance of each series. In my opinion, I think that is part of the problem. So, for example, it's worth remembering this is quite a regional problem as well. It's not an English problem. Like, England can pack out its test grounds without difficulty. Yep. It's not actually really an Australian problem. They similarly have a lot of success selling tickets and attracting interest for their games. But I think around the world, I think there's a sense that test series have lost context. There's a sense that they haven't been... cricket fans are unable to relate them to a bigger picture. Bigger picture could be provided by a conclusive end of game to which the entire test calendar built up to.
I don't know if that's necessarily true. I mean, if you look at dwindling crowds in, say, the West Indies, I think that's got a lot to do with the fact that the West Indies aren't a very good cricket team anymore. Mm. I don't think it's necessarily.
India are a pretty good cricket team.
I don't think
though.
It's necessarily a lack of context that necessarily does away with it. I think that cricket is subject to, and this is a completely different debate, but I think cricket is subject to wider cultural forces, like the fact that people don't want to follow something that happens over 5 days anymore, and I just think this is going to be cosmetic, and what Test cricket needs is something which is actually much more fundamental in the way it's played, in the way it's approached.
I'm happy to concede that this is not a solution in itself to the problems Test cricket has, but I can't necessarily see what harm it would do as an introduction. I mean, I could accept your point that a Test Championship in itself is not going to solve the ills of Test cricket, but I don't think I can see necessarily that it's going to cause harm.
I don't think it's a good idea to get rid of sorry everyone, that was my phone going off, and in trying to answer it, I dropped my laptop on the floor.
Pretty dramatic all round.
It all went horribly wrong. But I don't think that I've completely lost my train of thought. How is this going to be harmful? I don't think you should. I think you should introduce things for a positive reason, not because they've not got a negative.
No, I'm saying it will probably have a positive impact, and I think you were suggesting in your diatribe that this might actually sort of do harm to the game. That this
might
actually be a negative.
I think it might. It will. Could stop the real issues within the game being addressed. I think also it could detract from the way that. From the potential success of playing cricket in series, which I think we've seen in the past can be very successful. Mm. And I think we should give that a proper go before we actually throw that out completely. Because this would, in a sense, end up throwing that out completely. Because
we both agree. I mean, I certainly feel the biggest innovation Test cricket needs to make is in the whole Future Tours programme. The schedule is a farce. Yep. I mean, we were talking about last week... The fact that Australia and South Africa are playing a two test series is ludicrous. Yep. But I would suggest that having a final endpoint might well add impetus to that whole thing. It might well help to create a system in which countries play each other more regularly, perhaps the more appropriate number of times.
Last week you were saying that there was nothing better than a five test series. And you can't have five test series regularly if you're going to do it towards an endpoint. And actually, I think it devalues the... So if you have... obviously, there are hundreds of different ways that the test series could work, but I think it could potentially devalue individual games and individual series if they're working not towards an end in within themselves, but towards something, you know, which is why when you have, you know, group games in Football World Cup, that most of them are pretty boring and pretty meaningless.
I mean, perhaps moving away from the actual crux of the debate for a moment, I mean, this has been a postponement announced till 2017. Do you reckon it's a postponement, or do you think this is a kind of slow wiping under the carpet? I think we sweep things under the carpet generally.
You might wipe them under the carpet.
Unless they're particularly foul things that we're having to... Well, sorry, we're leaving it at that.
I think that it's certainly a bit odd the way that and actually, if anyone can enliven us, you can find us over on Cricket at Reverse Swept, because I would be interested to know
if, particularly if you're the head of the ICC
exactly what so the reason given, the public reason given, was that they could not get out of certain broadcasting contracts in time, and that it would mean various nations losing out on broadcasting fees, etc., which all sounds a little bit like the kind of thing that the ICC really should be able to get around if they really wanted to. And actually, a lot of people, interestingly, Andy Flower came out and said, look, we really need this. It's got to happen at some point. And
Graham Smith as well.
A few other big players came out and said, we really need this. But I don't know. Maybe there is some slight reluctance with the ICC. What impression do you get?
I increasingly get the feeling they may have put feelers out as such, and they maybe don't feel. The key thing is the money, isn't it? At the end of the day, I think they may have seen this.
Don't do things
from the ICC's perspective. I think they expected perhaps this to be more lucrative than it has turned out to be, and I think that might well be. And perhaps this is the tragedy of the whole thing, that if it ever gets done, it will be done because the ICC thinks they will make a considerable buck out of it rather than the long-term future of the game.
So thank you for listening to the 23rd episode of Reverse Web Radio. Tune in next time to hear about... I don't really know what we're going to be talking about next time.
We haven't really
cast our minds that far forward.
It'll be gripping.
So it'll be a surprise for all of us.